Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, this is Devron Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the fourth week of January. This week, we are very pleased to have Patrick Loafman as our guest, speaking with us about his 20 years of botanizing in Olympic National Park, and a book that he's putting together to help identify all of the cool plants that occur there. But before we get to our main topic, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. There was a rare sighting of this cool creature at the Kaitai Nature Park a couple of weeks ago, and I have been longing to catch sight or sound of it myself. We'll play it again at the end of the program and tell you what it is. And while we wait for Pat to meet us at the studio, here is Charlie Fleischman to help me share this week's observations and events.
We had some sad news recently from the Center for Whale Research up in Friday Harbor, telling us that the orca matriarch Granny has not been seen since last October and is now presumed dead. She was born in 1911 and would have been 106 years old this year. 2016 has not been a good year for the southern resident orca population, with their numbers now down to 78 individuals.
Speaking of orca, there was a really interesting paper out recently exploring menopause in killer whales. Did you know that only humans, orca, and short-finned pilot whales are known to go through menopause? Female killer whales start having young around 15 years of age, but stop having young in their mid-30s. Why should they experience menopause so early, or at all, when they have such a long lifespan?
Researchers theorize that it has to do with minimizing competition with their daughters, with whom they continue to share a close-knit family group, leaving the matriarch to share food and the knowledge of where to find it, which helps the family as a whole to succeed.
It's a really cool study. You should dig a little deeper and see if you can read the whole thing. Our friend Jeff Hammerson sent us another wonderful photo essay of current natural history events. He notes that the red-winged blackbirds already are singing and hanging out in some of the marshes where they nest each year. Black-capped chickadees have also been singing, along with Hutton's vireos. When the Kaitai Lagoon was frozen, mallards, widgeons, and coots had to resort to feeding on land in thick grass and on lawns.
Buds are opening on some of the willows at the lagoon, exposing the fuzzy ends of the catkins. Robins and waxwings have eaten almost all of the fruits of the many non-native hawthorns around town, and now the robins are focusing on the still abundant holly fruits. In the mammal world, the breeding season is now over for our deer, but the males still have their antlers. Red-backed voles have been active on the forest floor. They stay active all year, even in the cold of winter.
And lastly, some additional information on the amazing variability in annual precipitation in our area. I was astonished to hear Al Latham's information sent into Nature Now a couple of weeks ago, stating that the normal average rainfall for his station, 5 miles south of Chimicum, was almost 35 inches a year. Didn't I remember that Port Townsend's rainfall was about half that? I checked it out and found that indeed that is the case. And Squim is the driest place on the peninsula, with about 16.5 inches. But if you head down south a mere half hour to Quilcene, you'll get about 52 inches of rain, and you swing west to Forks for a staggering 118 inches annual rainfall. But this pales compared to the roughly 134 inches of rain falling upon the Quinault Ranger District. The tremendous effect of the rain shadow in our area never fails to astonish me. Patrick Loafman is a field biologist who has worked for Olympic National Park for over 20 years, studying everything from spotted owls to amphibians. He has also spent a considerable amount of time studying the plants of the Olympic Peninsula while working for the Park Service, and is here with us today to speak about his botanical forays, along with a field guide that he's putting together. Welcome, Patrick.
Well, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you. So, what sort of plant research projects have you been doing on the Olympic National Park? And are these studies ongoing?
Starting in 2007, I was working on a forest plot survey, which focused mainly on small plants. It was a 100 by 100 meter study area, and it was looking at changes over time, long-term study of monitoring of plant changes in forest ecosystems. And that was for here in Olympic Park, Rainier, and also in North Cascades, but I did most of the work here in the Olympics.
Uh-huh.
The funding kind of got cut on the smaller plant stuff. We were looking at everything down to mosses, lichens, and liverworts, which was really fun. With the funding cuts, we went down to just studying trees and tree mortality for 5-6 years, and that eventually got cut too, unfortunately. But I was looking at tree mortality, and there's been many long-term studies which have shown tree mortality over time has been increasing, unexplained really why. They thought it was due to possible global climate change without enough recruitment to replace that loss. So,
Because we don't get the usual insect infestations that a lot of areas get, right?
Yeah, that seems to be more on the east side of the Cascades. You definitely see a lot more of the insect attacks. And most recently, I've been studying subalpine and alpine. It's a long-term monitoring project just to look at change of communities up high in the Olympics. It's also we're also doing work there in the Cascades and Rainier also.
Is there still funding to look at that?
But yeah, it is, at least for next year. It's always a sort of a year-to-year thing a lot of times to know how long these long-term projects really get to go.
Uh-huh.
But it's planned to go for a long-term to also look at just how's climate change affecting subalpine vegetation.
So has your work involved any habitat restoration? Have you been involved in any of the Elwha River restoration work?
I've done some seed collecting for the and some planting in the winter on the old lake beds, which is pretty tough work.
Yeah.
It's really rocky habitat. It's amazing any of those plants survive.
Yeah.
There's a lot of rock, too, and you just plop those things in and hope they do well. But surprisingly, they've had quite a good success at revegetating that area. Plus, there's been a lot of native plants coming in from the forest. So,
Josh Chenoweth was here about a year ago, I think, talking about that. And I would like to have an update on what's going on there because things are changing so quickly.
It is. And it's nice to see a lot of the trees coming in because that'll help keep the weeds out.
Your primary focus right now is in the subalpine area in the park. And what plant communities or plant species do you feel are most threatened in the park?
Well, I would think that the highest of the high, some of these plants that are right up on the ridge tops only, we have several of those that if climate change does warm up, temperatures warm up, they don't have anywhere to go up to get cooler temperatures. Also, there'll be more drying or quicker drying because of less snowpack.
Uh-huh.
And that could cause some problems with species that require more moist habitats. But I would think the high alpine would be the most at risk.
Are they expecting to see major changes in the plant communities in the alpine areas, or they're just going to die back and other plants will take over, or you'll just end up getting a dearth of plant species, period?
It's most likely, you would think that the lower elevation species would move up higher, maybe booting out these species that are there, or some of the plants will move up slope. So some of the lower elevation species may come up and start appearing and competing with these higher elevation species as the temperatures change.
So you were telling me that while doing your many years of plant work, that you came up with your own system for keying out plants and decided to share it with the rest of us in the form of a field guide?
Part of the reason, we work deep in the park, and I don't like carrying a whole bunch of books because we're already carrying stuff like rebar and all this weight for 7 days. So I started carrying just a list of all the species for the last couple of years for the high country only for Olympic National Park and having sort of a one-line description. And over time, I've also started developing, because some genuses have many, many species, and it's easier to use a key than just to look at a list. So I started developing some keys also to identify some of these species.
So aren't there already plant guides for this area? How will yours be different?
Well, it's going to be a complete guide. So I was going to try to cover the entire Olympic Peninsula all the way down to the Oregon border, and also throw in the islands, like the San Juan Islands. And there's some books out there that cover the area, but they're incomplete. Or the most complete one would be Hitchcock's Floor, which includes a larger range, but is a little bit out of date with the names and is definitely not portable because it's a huge book. So hopefully it'll also be a more portable guide that will cover all the species in this area.
So you're actually writing original dichotomous keys to plant species. Could you explain a bit about how you go about that? And I suppose we should start with explaining a bit about how botanists identify plants by, quote, keying them out in the first place.
The dichotomous keys, you have two choices. So at the beginning of a key, if something real simple might ask you, is the flower red or is the flower white? So you look at your plant, say, okay, it's a red flower. And then you'll go one way to two more questions. They may ask you about this or that. And you keep going to, at the end, you'll get a species name. If you choose white, you go a different way and you have different questions. It's always these two questions and you got to choose one. And sometimes it's hard to choose between the two because it's not always black and white. It may be like a measurement. Is the leaf 3 to 4 millimeters wide or 4 to 5? And you got a leaf that's 4 millimeters. So you could go either way. So sometimes you have to go both ways in that key and see which one works better. And that's how the keying process works. When I was started writing this book and my shortcut keys, I was more interested in how botanists think when they go out in a spot. Because they have some shortcuts, you know, there's plants you can identify just by the leaves alone, and you don't have to peer into the flowers at all. These shortcuts I'm hoping to include too. Or you might have a genus where there's three species, only one is in the subalpine, alpine, and the rest are down low on the coast. So you can write a key that would say, is this subalpine, alpine habitat or low elevation below 1,000 feet? And that is sort of a shortcut, an easier choice. Trying to make it easier is the main goal.
It's intimidating for a lot of people because the language is so dense. I mean, it's a separate language all into itself. How many hairs and yep. how you classify those hairs?
Probably over 100 words for hairs. I don't know. It's quite confusing. And so when you're keying out, you're almost always going back and forth in a glossary. And so I'm trying to choose how much of the terminology you also need to use. And that's difficult, too, because I still want it to be valid. I'm not trying to shortcut them in that way, but sometimes you can describe the hairs instead of using the name, and that sometimes helps.
And one of the most useful things about these keys are the drawings that illustrate what differentiates the species. Are you going to illustrate the key yourself?
I'm trying to do some illustration. It's not heavily illustrated, but sometimes you're looking at really small parts that a photograph won't pick up, and I'm also using photographs of the species. But if you're looking at something small on the seed, sometimes a drawing will help explain it. Like in one part in a mint identification, the key says, is there a transverse process on the sepal? Which is a really confusing statement. But if you look at the drawing, there's this sort of ridge-like thing on the sepal, and you say, oh, that's what they're calling a transverse process. And it explains it better. So sometimes when words fail, I'm going to try to put in a small illustration to help that out.
Or a large illustration. I mean, part of my complaint with Hitchcock is that the illustrations are so small that it's hard to know what they're talking about a lot of times.
That's true. The original Hitchcock was in, what, 5 volumes? And that shortened one volume is what you usually see. When I work at the park, I actually get to look at the 5 volumes.
Well, I actually have.
Oh, you do?
I have the 5-volume set. And the drawings there are on a large scale, and they're really lovely. But yeah. By the time they're shrunk down to fit into that condensed
into the key part, yeah.
group, you really can't see very well
yeah.
what they're talking about. The term big year has gained fame after the book and movie about birders trying to see as many birds as they can in 1 year, and I heard you're trying to do a big year in plants, complete with photos. So tell us about that.
Yeah, one thing I'm really falling short so far on the book is photographs, and there's a lot of species. We're talking about probably a little over 1,600 species. So I was going to see how many of these I could see in 1 year, identify and hopefully get photographs of a lot of them. And so I'm doing that like a birder, but maybe I'm going to start early February and to see how many I can get. And it'd be exciting to see what I could turn up.
Wow.
In 1 year.
So 1,600 species, that's including the San Juan Islands and all the way down, how far down the coast?
All the way to the Oregon border.
Uh-huh.
So, and that's estimate. I'm not sure. I haven't tallied it up yet, but that's kind of a guess of how many there's out there. It's daunting, and I'm going to try, you know, common things and uncommon. So weeds are exciting, too. I was just noticing today I deliver bread for a bakery, and I saw some little chickweed starting to flower in a little cracked piece of concrete. So it keeps you looking. If you're trying to identify everything, then you're always looking at stuff, and you find interesting things anywhere,
yeah,
even the weeds. So
it's true. So how far along is your book?
Well, I got a lot of the keys, a draft done. I still got a few big families left to do. And I got a lot of the descriptions done. Photographs are going to take a lot of work. I'm going to try to print up a draft copy just to bring in the field for the whole next year to work out the kinks, just to make sure I didn't make any errors or whatnot on the key process. Because that's been a big job, trying to get it accurate and to work, and have some copies for other people to look at to see if there's anything confusing or how it's written or whatnot.
Yeah, that would be great. Is the botany crew on the park, are they on board to help you test it?
Yeah, there's some people that do some long-term research on the lake beds, so I may give them a copy, and there's, of course, the Native Plant Society. A lot of them might give me some input to really help.
Yeah, well, you're coming to speak to the Native Plant Society, so you can put in a plug there for people to take your key out. When do you think you'll have the key ready to test?
Hopefully by March.
Wow, so you're close.
It's getting there, so yeah. I haven't done only a few illustrations, so that's something I'm going to add afterwards while I'm working out the kinks, too.
Uh-huh.
Figure out where's the best place to put in some drawings. But photographs, that's why I'm trying a big year. I did quite a bit of photographing last year, but realized I didn't get much at all done, even though sometimes I took up to 300 pictures in a week. Still got a long way to go.
Well, you have to time it right to get the plant in its perfect flower, and then ideally get a picture of it with its seeds also.
Yeah, it's tough, and it's tough to get a good picture, especially of small things, and grasses are really tough too because they're moving in the wind and you get all these blurry photographs. One good one out of 10 or.
In a lot of botany texts, line drawings are the very best. The photos are really pretty, but a good line drawing helps you to see the detail in a way that a photo is difficult to see a lot of times.
It can, yeah. And I was looking at some of the photographs I was going to show tonight, and one of the grasses, showing two species of grasses, and one has this bright red seed head, and the other one was brownish, but the red has actually nothing to do with identification of the plant, and any of them could have been reddish or grayish, but yeah, sometimes a photo may throw you off that way, because you're looking
at the
wrong
character. It's just an aberration.
I don't know why that was reddish, but it really shows up, and it's like, well, that's not the important character, but... So that's sometimes, but other times the picture really helps out because you can look at it and see a lot of things at once. You can see the leaves, you can see and a bit of the habitat sometimes.
And just the general form of the plant.
And that does help out a lot.
Yeah.
It's hard to explain everything in words, and that's a lot of times where the photos and drawings really help out to fill in those gaps.
Thanks so much for joining us, Pat, and best of luck to you with your book project, and... best of luck with the botanical big year.
Yes, thanks.
We have a couple of upcoming natural history events to tell you about, both occurring on Saturday, January 28th, and both sponsored by the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society. The first is a field trip to Eda's Hook up in Port Angeles from 9 a.m. till noon. The second is a class on the corvids in winter and takes place from 10 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. at the Dungeness River Audubon Center outside of Sequim. The class starts with a 90-minute lecture, followed by a 2-hour field trip. Go to OlympicPeninsulaAudubon.org to pre-register and get more information.
And here's our mystery sound again. It's a long-eared owl. And even though I've studied owls in our area for a long time, I have never seen one. I love the description of these birds that Nan Evans found on Cornell University's All About Birds website. Quote, long-eared owls are lanky owls that often seem to wear a surprised expression thanks to long ear tufts that typically point straight up like exclamation marks. These nocturnal hunters roost in dense foliage, where their camouflage makes them hard to find, and forage over grasslands for small mammals, unquote. Birders from the Admiralty Audubon Group were very lucky to stumble across one roosting in the Kaitai Nature Park during the first week of January. A new species recorded there. These birds are rare breeders and uncommon winter visitors in western Washington, but they're fairly common year-round in eastern Washington. In winter, they are believed to be most common in the wheat country of southeastern Washington, with roosts of up to 50 birds in Walla Walla County, which I would love to see. And that's it for KPTZ's Nature Now for the fourth week of January. Thanks very much for joining me, Charlie, and thanks to all of you for listening. Remember, if you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 11:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org.
Happy trails!
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is Rain, sung by Patty Griffin.
Against the stone and steel walls that I won't climb. Sometimes the hurt is so deep, 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 you think that you're gonna drown. Sometimes all I can do is weep, weep, weep with all this rain. Things you want will just never be right.